This last lecture will be devoted to gauge theory, and I'll continue to discuss some aspects of normalization, but shortly, because I have no time to make detailed calculation, and on the other hand, they are quite tedious. And I'll speak more about the consequence of this calculation and the physics of gauge theory, in particular confinement, which is, of course, one of the very important features of non-abelian gauge theory. So first, let me just hand shortly the calculation of the renormalization at one loop. I remind you that the Feynman rules for the 3 and 4 gluon or gauge bosons particles in terms of both their color indices. This is for SU2. So A is 1, 2, 3, and the mu's are Lorentz indices, which are associated to the spin, the polarization degree, the freedom of the gauge bosons. And you have a 3 boson interaction and a 4 boson interaction with the structure constant of the group appearing, and some combination of, well, this is here in the Euclidean, so you have delta mu nu, but otherwise, it's just the metric tensor H mu nu and of the momenta. So this basically tells you that you have an interaction between the momenta of the bosons and the spin. Some kind of spin orbit interaction, which is, and these coefficients are enforced by the group structure, the symmetry of the group, and this is enforced by Lorentz and Poincaré invariance. Okay, and of course I've not represented the fact that you have also the gauge boson interaction. I'm not writing here. Okay, and so we discussed the fact that at d equal 4 you have ultraviolet divergence, the theory is renormalizable. Well, it's because the coupling, that's because the coupling constant has dimension 0. Therefore, it's renormalizable, like exactly Q in QED. And you have ultraviolet divergence, which appears in dimensional regularization as poles in D minus 4. That's using dimensional regularization. But I try to convince you that there is a natural dictionary between log lambdas divergences using momentum cutoff, which is a bit difficult to implement for gauge theories technically, and dimensional regularization, which has the advantage to preserve both Lorentz symmetry. It keeps the structure of the G mu nu or delta mu nu index, and it guarantees gauge symmetries. Okay, and we have discussed in detail for the one loop for the one loop 2-point function. I made a calculation. Well, I skipped a few steps, but basically, it tells you that there is a 1 over d minus 4 here with a correct structure for preserving gauge invariant. Term. In terms of the incoming momenta, the A and the mu and the B and the nu. Because basically it was the same form as the action. Okay. So now I won't have time to discuss for the 3-point function, but we have seen that for the 3-point function, you have a sum of diagrams, which you have three kind of different diagrams, irreducible diagrams, which are, in fact, a loop of gauge field, some variation of it, where you replace this by a vertex. You have four of them, and then you have minus important the ghost loops. Okay, and well, you can write what is the amplitude in terms of internal momenta. Okay, and you can check that the Feynman integral associated of this graph is basic of the form d dk. Well, there is a factor, it's not very important here. You have a k squared to the power 3 because you have three propagators. And in the numerator, you have a complicated factor which involves the external momenta. Let's call it P, Q, and R. Yes, like here. And the K. Basically, the coefficient which is Danrus, which will give a pole in D equal 4, are terms of the forms 2K with some indices, and et cetera, and some combination of P but here just in fact some either P, Q and R only once, okay, with indices, and this gives a potential 1 over d minus 4 poles because you have an integral over d k to the power d, then you have k divided by k squared, so this is of order k to the 4, so this is logarithmically divergent integral. Okay, so basically what you have to see what is in terms of of indices a, b, c, and the mu nu rho, what is the coefficient here of this one. Okay, and it's not very difficult to convince when you study what's going on there, but because precisely of gauge symmetries and of Lorentz invariance, that what can come out must be basically proportional to this term. So you can only, this term. So we are going to have this term with this delta AB, this combination of delta mu nu and the component rho of some momenta. And basically, you can't have anything else. If you had an R here, you would have an R mu, but you can rewrite R always in terms of K and P, because you have P plus K, P plus Q, plus R equals 0. And by the symmetries, it must be K minus P. Yeah, it cannot be K minus 2P or K plus P. Because when you invert some legs, you have to change the signs in order to compensate the change of signs in the epsilon AB. You see. So the symmetries impose, that's the same term, that's the same A, B, C, mu, nu, rho, P, Q, R term than the vertex. So it's going to be, well, you can write this later, that the V3, the three vertex term divided by D minus 4. With some coefficient, some number. Let's call this, I don't know, C3. Coefficient. Okay. In the same way that here, we had got for this, the propagator, p mu p nu minus g mu nu p squared, times delta AB, with the coefficients, C2, let's say, which was found in my case, I think it was 1/3 or something like that, to be checked. So by calculating this more complicated integral, you get a coefficient C3. Okay. And so this guarantees that you have a, in fact, you start from the action, which contains an A term. And you, here you have an A term times the coupling constant in the original action. And the fact that there is a divergence means that you have to introduce a counter term. So you have to change the action by, instead of having a bare action, which is a very A plus G A, no, A plus G A. I'm very sketchy. I forget everything of the indices and indices. You have, in order to have a theory which makes this point function and this two-point function finite, you must introduce a counter term, namely have a 1 minus C2 divided by D minus 4 with a G squared, of course, because this is a graph of order G squared. A plus here the term which is G 1 minus C3 over D minus 4 G squared A. You see. Basically, if this is the action, this is the renormalized action you must use to construct a renormalized theory. This is the S renormalized of A that you must use. Okay. So you see that if you have those two terms, they can be absorbed. They correspond to a renormalization of A. You can write that A is Z some A bar here, and G, and the coupling constant is Z, G, G bar, if you want. This is a new, call this G bar, you see. So, if you know those two terms, you know that performing a field renormalization and a coupling constant renormalization is enough. It works. Okay. So it's exactly like in QC. It's exactly like in QED, where you had in QED instead of having those diagrams with the internals, you know. Where are they? This diagram, those diagrams which correspond to a polarization of the vacuum here via the fermion field, but here the gluon itself intrudes. So this diagram induces a field renormalization for the gauge field. And this diagram, well, you had also this diagram for the fermions. So you had a field renormalization for Dirac, a field renormalization for A. And you had these diagrams, which is the renormalization of the coupling. So combining those three terms, if you have calculated those three terms, you renormalized A, you renormalize the Dirac field psi and renormalize the Kuprey constant of QED, which is E squared. Here, I have no Dirac field, but so I get a renormalization of A. A and G, the gauge coupling. So that's enough to compute. Okay, but now in the action, you have also a terms G squared A. Which is going to require also a renormalization. So this is going to be replaced by G times G squared times 1 minus some C4 divided by D minus 4 G squared A. And in addition, you have the renormalization for the ghosts. And so that's for the quadratic term. And you have a normalization for the ghost. And you have to check that everything is consistent. Because if you replace in the gauge action, you know, in the original gauge action, you know that these terms and these terms are not independent. Gauge symmetries enforce a relation between the coefficient which involves 4A field and the coefficient which involves 3A field together with the coefficient of 2A field, which in the original gauge action is 1. So they are not independent. So you have to check that this coefficient, C2, C3 and C4, which are numbers, here is C2, are consistent. With the gauge symmetry. Okay. And it works. You have also to check it for the ghosts, because the ghosts are coupled to the gauge field. So you have a propagator for the ghost. You have a propagator for coupling between the gauge field and the ghost. So this is C bar A. And the coefficient here is has some group structure, Lorentz and gauge field, and it has a charge which is the same than for the gauge field. So you have to check that the renormalization of the charge of the goal is the same as the renormalization of the charge for the gauge field. Again, it works thanks to gauge symmetry. Okay. So the renormalization of the charge is the same for the gauge field and the ghosts. Okay. Well, and one way to achieve that in the calculation is to use BRST symmetry, for instance, but I won't discuss that. That's too technical. Okay, so the final results, which I think historically why first such a calculation was first performed in the beginning of the 30s by Gerhard Toft, was to show that at least at one loop, and then this was proven at shortly after at any loop, that gauge series are indeed renormalizable. Okay, so now I think, let me mention some history. First, I think it was around 71 or 2. Gerhard Toft proved that at one loop there were, did a calculation showing that there were. This was extended later on, I think around 74, at all loop by Lee and Saint-Justin, using subtechniques of Ward identities. Maybe this was done by other people. I've not checked all the history. And a bit later on, end of the 60s, BRST symmetry was invented that provided an alternate and, in fact, more lighter proof by BRST, by Becky or West or and Twitlin. Okay. Okay. So, maybe before discussing the physics, in particular the sign of the beta function, which was of course the main outcome of this calculation, let me say a few words. Here I started to present, you know, the old-fashioned work of computing Feynman diagrams with all the spin and gauge indices. It's already messy in at one loop. It becomes very complicated. Because, for instance, you see that the two loop, the three boson vertex has already three or six terms with indices. This one is not symmetric, so in fact you have three diagrams. This one, because here you see that A, B, and C, D are not symmetric, there are some symmetry, but it has already two terms. But in fact, there are six terms if you take into account all the symmetries. So for a diagram like this one, you have 3 times 3 times 3 for this one. You have 27 terms. So that's why I couldn't manage to finish to be sure of that my calculation that I wanted to present was correct. Okay, so there are tricks. The same for this one. And it, you know, but it grows exponentially, of course, with a number of loops. So although the topological structure of the graph in the gauge theory are not that much complicated compared to Phi-4, for instance, because at two loops you can represent all the due to those symmetry factors and those momentum terms, basically associated to Lorentz and gauge symmetries, it grows, it has been done at two loops, but it grows practically intact. It's very difficult beyond that. Okay. So it's done. So, of course, theoretician physician have developed other techniques. And let me just mention two. I won't explain really what it is, but some more modern techniques to develop renormalization. The first one is to form, is to use something which is called the background feed gauge fixing methods. Well, it's not so new. It's explained in some detail in many textbooks, for instance, in the book by Peskin and Schroeder. Basically, The idea is to compute what's called, do you remember the effective action functional? Effective action. Action functional, gamma of phi, which you had in the phi 4 theory, which in one loop is given by the action plus 1/2 of trace of log of the derivative of the action with respect to variation of the field. Okay. Well, there is, of course, an effective action in gauge series, which is given by some the action, the Young-Mills action for a gauge field, plus 1/2 of trace of log of some operator. And to make a long story short, that's one loop plus higher order terms. Basically, you have the trace log of two operators. You have the operators which represent the one loop diagram carrying gauge field. You see? And basically, these are the trace log of an operator which is of the forms minus d d plus 2f, where d is d mu a is a covariant derivative operator in the background field A. So it depends on A in a non-trivial way. So let's write it dA. A is a background field. And A is a field strength associated to A, to the background field. So now A is a classical background, and this takes into account the quantum fluctuation around the background. So this is obtained by writing a calculation when you write the full gauge field. It's a background field plus some quantum fluctuations. It's the same idea of calculation, but a bit more complicated. And in addition, you have minus the trace of a log associated to the ghosts, which turns out to be minus dA dr, but in a different representation. That's for the ghosts. Okay. And that's obtained in a particular gauge fixing when you enforce that dA mu of the quantum fluctuations is zero. So you say, so it's a generalization of the Landau gauge, where you take a covariant derivative in a background field and you enforce it to the gauge fluctuation. So that's called background. Gauge fixing, yes, that's it. Okay, so, and with this method, you can see how those trace log operator, what is the structure of the infrared divergence, of the short distance divergence by method which are called the heat kernel expansion. Kernel expansion. Methods, which are a way to study the behavior of these differential operators, which are differential operators in a background curved background field. Okay, so this is a method developed by mathematicians. Of course, it's complicated because those operators contains, they are covariant derivatives, so d mu, a mu, but they contain also group structure. And the fact that FA is different from 0 means there is curvature in the group manifold. And okay, and from that you get the same, you can get the coefficient of the renormalization, the counter terms, in a bit shorter way. But at the price of understanding what are those heat kernel expansion methods, which is something non-trivial either. But let me mention that. So this was the first modern techniques I wanted to mention. And the second modern technique was, this was one, which is much more involved. And two are amplitudes techniques, which consists in, instead of computing Feynman diagrams, just to study the S matrix element, where you have on-shell gauge bosons. Okay, of course, the techniques of studying the structure of scattering amplitudes is old. It's even sometimes even as old or older than modern quantum field theory. But there has been a renewal for this technique in the last maybe 20 years for many reasons. And in fact, connected to also development in string theories. And quantum gravity. That's quite remarkable fact. Because if you have on-shell gauge bosons, you see, so that's k squared equals zero. They are characterized, they are on-shell and they are physical. So they are characterized by on-shell momentum, energy momentum k. This one particle state is characterized by one shell momentum k and the polarization. And a polarization of massless gauge bosons, as you know, studying it in electromagnetism, it can have only two transverse polarizations. Or if you preserve in terms of polarized light, circular light, it can have a polarization which is left-right oriented or either clockwise or anticlockwise. So you have polarization which can be plus or minus. This is a polarization. Okay. And there are some remarkable formula for studying at least at one loop those depending on the polarization. For instance, you can consider what's happening when you have two polarizations like that. You have a lot of simplification, for instance. Many different shows of polarization give S matrix amplitude which are zero by just some law of conservation. Okay. And out of that, you have techniques to study these amplitudes in a more efficient way than painfully with your little foot and your little hands. You take care of all the symmetric coefficients and you make big contraction. Okay. So that's something which is to be mentioned, because I'm sure you'll see that later on. So there are techniques which are very important now, both in high energy physics. They are used to compute a lot of processes in view of the experiments in, for instance, LHC and high energy colliders, and in string theory and quantum gravity. Okay. So I wanted to mention that just for your lecture. But now, let's go to the main results, which is, of course, the main result of Toft, the beta function for a gauge theory. The final results of Toft, which was really a revolution and which led to the revival of gauge theories for high energy, is that if you consider, yes, sorry.
With this, I didn't understand the punchline. So you said there's a technique.
There are techniques to compute
the S matrix using polarization somehow. Is that what you said?
Yes, in terms of the polarization of the momenta. And you can compute it using techniques not directly involving Feynman diagrammatics, using analyticity properties of the amplitudes.
Is there like specific names or is it just like some?
I'm not an expert of those, but the modern development occurred in the last 20 years, so they cannot be found, I think, in the older textbooks. Although there is, of course, a lot about amplitude calculation in old textbooks, because that's what they done. But I think if you go to some modern quantum field theory method, the one I know which discusses that is a master course written by one of my colleagues in Saclay, whose name is François Gélis. It's another François, which I think discusses that. But it's a very recent book. I think it's written in English, I hope. But I'm sure there are others. So if you're interested, go there. Okay, so now let me back. I'll discuss that after the break. But the beta function of Gale theory is found to be, this is a celebrated result of Toft. For SU2, this is, let's do it for SUN. We have computed calculation for SU2, but it's valid for SUN. Let's consider that, in fact, you see that the real coupling constant is not G, but G squared. So the coupling constant is alpha equal G squared. It's exactly like in QED. And the beta function for alpha is, as you can expect, is proportional to alpha squared. It's a one loop effect. There is a 1 over 4 pi squared, which is can be reabsorbed in the definition of alpha, if you like. And you get, finally, well, instead of a 10-third, well, there is some combination which is true, and it's found to be 11 over 3 with a minus sign and a coefficient which depends on the group, which for the group SUN is n. So for SU2 it's 2, for SU3 it's 3. And if you have fermions, NF Dirac fermions coupled, it's plus 4 over 3 NF times 1/2. So, okay. So this is a number of colors. This comes from the gauge, plus the ghost, of course. And this comes from matter. Yes?
You're assuming the fermions are in the fundamental representation?
Pardon?
You're assuming the fermions are in the fundamental representation?
Yeah, they are in the fundamental representation, yes. Like in QED, in the fundamental representation. In fact, those coefficients here are associated to the representation here. The gate group acting on the field. So acting on the gauge field, that's a number associated to the fundamental representation. In fact, it's called the Casimir operator associated. And this one comes from the, is a Casimir operator associated to the fundamental representation for fermions. So they come from numbers called the Casimir operators. Okay, which are basically obtained, associated to some properties of the structure constant of the group. Okay. Well, so I won't detail. So the important fact, so this is the most important results of those calculations by in gauge series. And the important thing is, of course, that if there is a plus sign for fermions, there is a minus sign for Young mids. So if you forget about the fermions, so as long as you don't have too many fermions, the beta function as a function of the Kuiper constant has this sign. So that's for gauge theory, which is different from the beta function has a function of either alpha for the fine structure constant, or lambda of or g for phi 4. For phi 4 0, which goes like that, which is positive. Actually, this formula contains QED, I think, because for QED, the group is U1, so this constant is zero, but you have Dirac fermions with a plus sign, and so there is a beta function in QED, which comes only from the effect of virtual loops with fermions. So I think with the correct normalization, that's a calculation you did in QED for this coefficient. Okay. So QED or phi 4, the beta function is positive. Here it's negative. And well, let's make a break. So the beta function is negative. Here it's positive. And the physical properties of the two kind of theory are fundamentally different. So that's what I'm going to discuss after the break. Okay? Yes?
Can I find some representation so that the beta function is exactly zero?
No, because basically that's a Casimir for a compact group. This has to be positive. Examples where the beta function is zero must involve fermions and gauge field, either adjusted or better, some supersymmetric gauge series. So if you consider some supersymmetric gauge series, there are some consolation. There might be some consolation. And if you know a bit of supersymmetries, it turns out, as far as I know, that for, you know, supersymmetries is characterized by the number of supersymmetric generators. So you can have n equal 1, Suzy, n equal 2, Suzy, and n equal 4, Suzy, basically. And I think that here there are some simplification. I think that for some n equal 2 Suzy, the beta function is exact at one or two loop. That's a result that has been obtained in the 80s by some Russian theoreticians. And most important, for n equal 4 supersymmetric gauge series, one can show that in many forms, the beta function is exactly zero. Okay? But for a generic either n equal 1 supersymmetry or non-supersymmetric gauge series, and it seems that the universe in which we live is at our energy scale, you know, described by non-supersymmetric gauge series, we have not found, discovered any supersymmetric partner of the particles. We know as some famous saying says, supersymmetry is a very successful theory because it already predicts half of the particles which should exist. But that's the jokes of anti-symmetric people, symmetry people. Okay, anyway. In general, the beta function is non-zero. And it has to be negative. I think that if you try to construct a gauge theory or a non-compact group, like SU1, 2, for instance, instead of SU3, or SU1, 1. SU1, 1 is a non-compact group, non-trivial. But in that case, you have problem with unitarity. So it might be zero for some non-compact, or made positive for non-compact group. But that's, so I think that gauge theory is based on non-compact group. Like SU1, 1 are interesting. I think that there are some application for condensed matter. But you should ask the specialist here. But for high energy physics, you have problem with unitarity. That's all what I can say. Okay. Okay, so now let's assume that the break is finished and start again. So now that's okay, that's the number three. So what are the consequences of the fact that the beta function is basically of the form minus some constant, some the same than the one here, alpha squared is negative. At the difference with QED or a standard theory of interacting bosons. Remember, we discussed in renormalization group lecture that the beta function is not only some technicalities coming out from renormalization theory. It measures the scale anomaly. It measures the fact that the physics is not invariant under scale transformation. And classically, as for phi 4 in 4 dimension, you can check that classically, Young-Mill theory is scale invariance. Young-Mill is scale invariance. That's because in the action, A in 4 dimension, of course in 4 dimension, A has a dimension of mass, of the momentum, has dimension 1. And G, dimension of G, is 0. That's the dimension of momentum, energy dimension. And this ensures that if you perform adequate transformation on A and the energy or the distance, the action is the same and the coupling constant has not changed. But the fact that there is a beta function means that the scale invariance is spoiled at the quantum level. Okay, so there is a scale anomaly. The beta function measures the amount of violation by the quantum theory of the scale symmetry. It's a divergence of the current we have seen. And we have seen that one of the consequences of that is you can define the effective constant as a function of the energy, which is the effective constant you measure in, for instance, a collision process with momenta of typical energy E. You measure some quantity which gives you information about the strength of the interaction at this energy scale, and this defines an effective or running defining coupling at energy E, and from a simple argument about the behavior of renormalized wave function, you can see that in fact this variation with the energy of the effective energy is given by the beta function. It's a beta function of alpha effective or running of the energy. That's it. So the fact that the beta function is negative tells you that the higher the energy, at high energy, the smaller alpha S of E. So the strength of the interaction in high energy process is weaker than in high energy. Okay. So this property is called asymptotic freedom. Freedom, that's the very important property of gauge theories. It means that, of course, it's asymptotic freedom in the ultraviolet regime, in high energy. It means that the higher the energy, the weaker is the coupling, the weaker is the effective charge, the weaker is the coupling between gauge bosons, and also between gauge bosons and ghosts, and gauge bosons and fermions and particles. So it means also that when you go to high energy, perturbation theory becomes more reliable because it's an expansion in alpha. So it means that in the ultraviolet, the theory is safe. And so you don't run into the problem where of theory like QED or Phi 4, when you go to high energy, the effective coupling becomes infinite and you get into a problem of Landau-Pauli that I mentioned briefly, or Landau-Ghost particle. Okay, here you don't have the problem. The theory is safe, the perturbation theory is safe in the ultraviolet. So you attend that it's consistent. Quantum gauge theory should be consistent when you try to renormalize it. And in fact, some mathematicians and mathematical physicists have been able to prove rigorously in the sense of mathematics, that you can construct a gauge theory, at least a pure Young-Mills, exists in the mathematical sense, in the continuum limit. Okay. So that's not only something which is a reasonable law made by theoretical physicists, but it can be made a theorem. Unfortunately, the drawback of that is that in the infrared, the coupling constants become large, and you cannot trust perturbation theory anymore. So in fact, the proof, the mathematical proof of that exists for a gauge theory in a very tiny box. So in a tiny box, you can construct a gauge theory, which is consistent and infinite. But the tiny box, I think, those are people who have worked at that are mathematicians, so I'm making bounds and bounds and bounds over bounds. So I think this is, I don't know, maybe 10 to the power minus, I don't know, some large number Fermis, for instance, if you try to construct a theory corresponding to Young-Mills. So of course, this theorem is a mathematical theorem. It's interesting, but it has no physical consequence. Okay, the difficult and physically important problem is what happens at low energies. So how does those gauge bosons interact, and how do they interact with fermions at low energy? And we know that, of course, at low energy, the world of at least the QCD is made out of quarks, which are fermions, matter fields, and gluons, which are the gauge field. So they belong to the same to a representation of the group SU3 instead of SU2, but that's not important. And they interact strongly at low energy. And we all know, now one learns at least qualitatively at school, that in fact, nobody has been able, despite numerous attempts, to observe a free quark or a free gluon because of a phenomenon called confinement, which means that in fact, you have no isolated quark particles or gluon, no, but they can form singlets of the gauge group exists. If you form a combination of particles which form a singlet of the gauge group, something which has no charge, this is observable. And for instance, you have, when you have two quarks and accompanied by the sets of virtual gluons, this forms the mesons. So they're basically D quarks. Okay, we know that the usual hadrons, well, the most common species being the proton and the neutrons, are made out of three quarks. But for a long time, it has been debated whether tetraquarks and pentaquarks could be observed, which means that they had not too small decay time. And it seems that recently some experiment in nuclear physics showing that they might exist. But this has been, okay, so what's happened? Why does this object and this isolated quark do not exist? That's because of a phenomenon, very important characteristic of theory, which is called confinement. So confinement. So confinement is an essential property of gauge theories. It has been hinted and studied since the beginning, since the 70s, where Young-Mill theory were invented. And one important name associated to confinement is just the name of Ken Wilson. That's the same Ken Wilson of the OPE and the Ken Winfron Normalization Group for Critical Phenomena. But of course, there are many, many other names associated to this concept. And confinement basically means that is a consequence of the fact that in a gauge theory, imagine that you have a pure gauge theory. Plus some very heavy, let's see, infinitely massive fermions. Infinitely massive means that when you make an experiment at some fixed experiment, those fermions are there, and they cannot be, they cannot decay, they cannot create virtual particles because they are there. So then if you have two massive fermions, let's say you have a massive fermion which has plus and a massive fermion which has minus. Well, the fact that they are fermions are not very important. The important is that they are massive matter fields, particles, matter particles. particles, then it makes sense to treat the quantum gauge field as a quantum field, and the particle to stay classical. And you might define what is the effective potential, what is the potential, the energy, V as a function of the distance between those two particles. Okay, and in fact, that's just a generalization of the concept of looking at the Coulomb energy, which is two particles with opposite charge in QED. Okay, and we know that in QED, or in classical Maxwell, the potential V over R behaves like 1 over R. It decays as a function of R. And so therefore, the particles can be, with a finite energy, they can be separated from each other. One another, they found bound state, which is a pattern. Okay, so now in Young-Mills, there are strong arguments and results of numerical solution which state that this potential V over R grows like R. So the potential is linear. V. So the farther away they are, the stronger they are attracted. It's like having some spring between them, which means that they cannot be separated. Cannot be separated. Okay. So there are various arguments for this. This characteristic of QCD, confining potential, it can be measured by numerical simulation. There are phenomenological methods to estimate why this happens. There are various phenomenological models. If you want to prove that confinement exists, like this was done for gauge theories in a small box. This means if you can construct gauge theory in an infinite large box and show that it's confining, then you will become famous and somehow rich because there are some big prices. First, there is a price in mathematics called the Clay prices or the Clay. You will win, so I think it's $1 million, something like that. But I'm sure you will get some. So, okay. But you will get famous in any case. But that's still very far, far away from being proven mathematically. Well, one can prove some things in supersymmetric theory. There are results. For instance, for n equal 4 supersymmetric, you have a lot of exact results. But since there is no scale anomaly, there is no confinement. Okay. So. Let me finish this lecture by presenting briefly one of the important ways to formulate gauge theories, which led Ken Wilson to the idea of confinement, which is a formulation which is lattice gauge theory. So I will just only spend 20 minutes. So lattice gauge theory, in fact, it was invented also by Ken Wilson. That's at least the fourth achievement we mentioned of him. It led to confinement, so he led to confinement. It was also formulated an idea in a very special case by a condensed matter physicist called, Wegener, Franz Wegener, a famous condensed matter and statistical mechanics guy who has been interested in particular and critical phenomena for a very special gauge theory, which is a gauge theory based on the Z2 group, like Ising, in 3 dimensions. But because it's dual to the Ising model. But the general formulation is due to Ken Wilson. Okay, so the idea is replace space-time by a lattice in order to get a control of non-perturbative effects and get control of the ultraviolet problem. So we replace space-time by a lattice. Well, lattice, let's call it capital lambda, which is basically z to the power g. Well, you can formulate the theory on regular lattice, more complicated lattice, hexagonal lattice, but cubic lattice, okay. Well, we have seen that if we want to construct a field theory on a lattice, both for scalar fields and for fermions, the matter fields, like phi or psi, are associated to the sides. Those are the vertices. So I design it by I, just a vector in ZD. So it's I1 up to ID. Integers, the coordinates. So it's an integer vector. And I omit the vector. Okay. Now, can we define a gauge field on such a lattice? Well, you can, but it turns out that I had a lot of, but I don't think I will have to write everything. It turns out that the gauge field is a connection. So A mu A, in fact, it's a connection. It tells you how you perform a parallel transport on something which is called the fibers, the fiber bundles, which define the gauge theory. So in fact, if you can write, consider this as dx mu, a mu is a connection. That's the object, mathematical object that mathematicians call connection, which basically defines, a parallel transport. Well, in your general relativity course, you know that you know in curved space you have the Levi-Civita connection, which define what is parallel transport on the curved pseudo-Riemannian space, the curved Lorentzian space of general relativity. So that's the analog. That's a connection. That's an object that defines a parallel transport, but acting on the gauge field. Basically, if you have your space-time here, this is space-time, m, 1, 3, for instance, to each point of space, x, y, in fact, in a gauge theory is defined, well, let's call it just for u1. You have a group, for instance, here, u1, which is a circle, associated to each point of space. That's on which this object, this bundle, if you define, for instance, one line, that's the object where lives the gauge series. And so A mu tells you how you move from one fiber. Here you have a bundle. What's it called? A bundle. So you add things to each point of space-time, and the gauge field tells you how you move on this bundle from one fiber. This is fiber, fiber one to find that. So you have on each point. Okay. So you see that basically mu leaves is associated to how you transport things along. You transport your mathematical fields along some path from a point in space-time to another point of space-time. And this tells you, the A mu tells you how you, the corresponding variation of the fiber bundle. It's a very sketchy, but that, I think it's important to get the physical picture. Once you have get that, or the geometrical picture, once you have get that, the math are easy. Okay, so now, let's see. If I have a lattice, uh, movements, you know, paths are defined by just the path on the lattice. Oh, let me, maybe I need some color. Well, no, this red is very poor. Blue. Okay. This is a way. This is a path going from point one, well, I one to I two. Okay, so you have a path, and defining a transport for a gauge theory associated to group G means that I want to know I have a field which lives in the fundamental representation, for instance, of the group. For SU2, you have a field which have indices 1 or 2. And gauge field tells you how I can compare the field at this point to the point of this one. But you just have to know how to compare the field at this point to a neighboring point, you see. Once you've done that, you can compare. You can parallel transport your field, and compare it. Okay, so the idea is that basically the gauge field lives on the links of the lattice. You see? So to each edge, I have a hedge here. Let's call it this E. I and I plus unit vector in the direction mu. That direction mu. So mu can take four directions if we are in Z4. So to this edge, let's define an edge, I plus E mu. So you have four different, you have different edges rising from one vertex on your lattice. So let's call this edge E. I associate a gauge variable, but you see, E mu is just an infinite, defines an infinitesimal transport. So the gauge field has to live integrating in. So the gauge variable must be an element of the group, an element of the group. Here SU2. And this element of the group, let me call it G of E. This is the edge, E. Let's put a... Yeah, no, okay. So for instance, for SUn or for SU2 is going to be a unitary matrix. Okay. So to each oriented edge, you associate an element of the group. Well, of course, if you go there and there, then you recover the field. So a natural choice is that if you define E star, the opposite as E plus E mu E, so that's a reversed edge. I want G of E star to be G minus one of E, or G dagger of E, since we're in the case of an SU N group. Okay. So in fact, an element of the group is associated to, there is one independent variable for each unoriented edge. But once you take into the account, okay. Okay. So now, imagine that you have a field, a scalar field phi, associated to each point, which belongs to the fundamental representation of the group SU2. So it means it's a vector. the two vectors at each point. And I want to define what is the covariant derivative. What is the covariant derivative of B? I want to compute the covariant derivative of phi at I in the position in this direction. I want to define what is d mu phi of I. Ordinary derivative, you take the difference between phi of I and phi of I plus 1, rather the opposite. You see? But here, what you have to compare is phi of I plus e mu and the field phi transported by G, namely G of E times phi of I. That's a parallel transported field. So the operation of doing a parallel transform of field here along is I multiply phi by the G of this edge times the G of this edge times the G of this edge. You see? Okay. So now, what is a gauge transformation? What is a gauge transformation? Making a gauge transformation means making a gauge transformation at each point of the lattice. Gauge transformation, I associated a matrix U. Let's call it U in order not to be G. Well, usually the opposite. Okay. Gauge transformation, I associate a U, which belongs to SU2, a 2x2 matrix, to each point of the lattice. So gauge transformation. Okay. And under this gauge transformation, yeah, the choice is unfortunate because usually one denotes the link variable U. Yeah. Anyway, a gauge transformation on the field means that I multiply by U of I phi of I, so this is the phi prime of I. That's the gauge transform field. And then how can I make that the covariant derivative of the field transform covariantly? It's because if I want to transform the gauge element group associated to an edge, it defines a parallel transport. So you have to absorb the gauge transformation you have made here and here. You see? So I think, if I'm not mistaken, is that you have to take G of E. So remember that E goes to I. It goes to I to G with G equal I plus E mu. So the G associated to this, you have to multiply it to the, I think, to the link to the rest by E of I. Maybe there is a mistake, but I don't think so. That's U minus 1 of I times U of G. You see? And so this and this are the discrete version of gauge transformation in Minkowski space or RD, Euclidean. So performing a gauge transformation is multiplying by an elementary group, the group Elie fields which belongs to the site, and of course it depends on the representation of the field. So here, that's the gauge transformation for a field in the fundamental representation, and you see that in order to be consistent, G belongs to the adjoint. This is the transformation law for object living in the adjoint representation, which is the group itself. Okay. So, in order to define a consistent gauge theory with a low gauge invariance on the lattice, where gauge transformation associated to point on the lattice, the fields, matter fields, lives on the vertices of the lattice, and the gauge fields lives on the edges. Okay. Well, this I cannot move, so I have to go use maybe this one. And so a gauge, you see, a configuration of the gauge field is a collection of G associated to each edge. Now, what is the analog? Of F mu nu. F mu nu means that you associate something to a pair of indices to a site. So in fact, F mu nu on a lattice is associated to, you start from a site. You take, remember F mu nu is defined by the commutator of derivatives. Covariant derivative. But the covariance mean derivative means making the parallel transform of the field in this direction, mu. In one step. Then nu means that you make a parallel transform it in the direction mu. And you compute the difference with what you do if you go first in the direction mu and second in the direction mu. But comparing this to this is the same thing that doing this, and this, and comparing the original object to the final one. You see? And you know, when you make a parallel transport in Riemannian geometry along something like that, the curvature tensor of space-time is defined by the total holonomy when you perform, so when you perform this elementary step. So similarly, F mu nu is a curvature of the gauge connection defined on the lattice. So the curvature is just, you have a set. This is called the plaquette. I think it's a French name, and I don't know if it's an English word too, but we. Well, so that's an elementary plaquette. You see? And you see that associated to a site, you have many plaquettes because they can go in the different directions. That's associated to the pair mu and nu different with antisymmetry. Okay? And to each plaquette, let's call it P. As plaquette, this is a plaquette. The plaquette is oriented, of course. We can define the reverse plaquette. The curvature is going to be just the products of the field. So it's a G. So this is G. This is a link 1, 2, 3, 4. So it's going to be the products, the ordered product on the plaquette, ordered product along the plaquettes of the four edges, G of E for the edges of edges along the plaquettes. So it's going to be something like g of e4, g of e3, g of e2, g of e1. This is e1. Now I draw my placket without reference to the indices. So this is e1, this is e2, this is e3, this is e4. Okay. So that's the analog of F mu nu, or rather of the exponential of F mu nu. Because you see that, of course, there is something which is trivial. What is a pure gauge? What is a pure gauge? What is a pure gauge field? A pure gauge. A field whose strength tensor is zero. It's a field such that you can write any g of e for an edge going from I to G as some U of G, U minus 1 of E, I times U of J for some U. This is a pure gauge. That's the analog of stating that A mu is d mu of alpha, where alpha is basically the u is exponential I alpha. You see. And you can check, obviously, that for a pure gauge, if g of e can be written like that, this element of plaquette, well, let me call it u plaquette, mu plaquette. This for a pure gauge, u of the all u of the plaquette is 1, which is so u of p for a plaquette which is non-pure gauge, for a plaquette which is not a pure gauge, u of p is different from 1, and u of p is somehow the analog of exponential minus plus I f mu nu for the corresponding plaquette in the direction mu nu. Okay, so we have the in this beautiful lattice formulation of gauge theory, we have the analog of what are gauge fields. They live on the lattice. Vector fields, which lives on the link on the side of the lattice. What is a gauge transformation? And we have the analog of f mu nu. So now, in order to define the discretized gauge theory, we need to define an action. An action, which is not now the limit to S of combination of the G's for the links. And Wilson, of course, suggested that then the action has to be proportional to F mu nu squared. Remember that F mu nu is a an element of the gauge group. And it's equal to 1 when it's a pure gauge. We have to find something which is 0 when it's a pure gauge, or a constant, and which is smaller than 1, well, I'm sorry, larger than 1 when it's not a pure gauge. Okay, so Wilson suggested to take as a Wilson action just, well, up to some coefficient, the sum of all the plaquettes P. So summing over all the plaquettes means summing over all the sites and all the plaquettes attached to the site. So it's analog of the trace of 1 minus U of the plaquette. The U of the plaquette defined in this way. And that's the identity matrix, well, up to some coefficient. And you can check, well, for general group, you should take a real part. But for a unitary group, you can check, I think, that the trace is always, maybe that's just for SU2, that the trace is always a real number. So, OK, let's take R of that. That's a general definition. Well, of course, this definition is valid for any group. Okay, so you have, you take the trace, well, this is a constant. You can get it out of the trace. You have to take the the real part of the trace of minus u of p. And you can check that this is basically zero if u is if the gauge field is a pure gauge, then this is positive when it's non-zero. And of course, you have to put a 1 over alpha. Since I used unfortunately a g instead of a u, I don't write a coupling constant. So that's alpha. That's a coupling constant. The analog of. Okay, so this Wilson action makes the job. And out of that, you can define a discretized functional integral by integrating, so defining the analog of dA exponential minus 1 over g squared f of a. You define an integral, the product of all each edges of d mu of g of the edge where you use the R measure on the group. Which is the only measure which is invariant under gauge transformation of exponential minus 1 over alpha times the sum of a plaquettes of trace of 1 minus u of p real part. Okay, and of course for a finite lattice you can make the integration, and that's done by can be done by many methods, but in particular by computer simulation. Okay, and too late. So finally, let me mention one thing. Wilson, one of the achievements of Wilson was, come back to that, to show that when alpha is very large, when alpha, let me write it, when alpha is very large, well, I can write this here. And Wilson action, when alpha is very large, this coefficient is very small. And you can compute this potential V of R as a function of the distance between two quarks, let us say, on a lattice. On, you have your lattice, so you have your lattice which lives there, and you have, if you have n steps, and it shows that V of R can be computed as a function, it is basically 1 over alpha to the power n with some pi coefficients and some group symmetry, plus higher order terms. So you saw that it grows with the number. It grows with the distance. It's not directly to that. In fact, you can compute something which grows like that, which is exponential of minus the potential between the distance. So this grows like the logarithm of this grows like n. So he showed that the potential grows like n. So in this limit of strong coupling, there is confinement. While going further, I would like to introduce the concept of Wilson loops that I didn't have time to introduce, but that could be in my notes, future notes. So anyway, I'll stop there. I hope to have introduced you to the concept of lattice gauge theory, which is also an important concept that we meet if you are doing high energy physics. And there has been a lot of works. Now people are performing in particular a lot of numerical simulations on lattice, which are, let's say, reasonable size, and try to extract some continuum physics for this strong coupling expansion. and I'll end up there. So thank you for your attention. I hope you have enjoyed this course and it will be useful for you for the rest of your courses here. And thank you for your attention. It was pleasant to be there, I hope. And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.